Sorry, we're on Daf Beis Amid Beis in Masechta Sota, as you know, and we're up to the words Askalta de Tumahi. So first let's find the place, and then the Mirtz Hashem will give a little bit of background and review a drop of what we did yesterday, so that we know where we're up to. And I'm going to try to get from Simcha an accurate time when this shiur begins, because I was under the misimpression we're supposed to start at 9:30, and I actually cut down my previous shiur for that, so I lost almost 10 minutes of my shiur based on that misunderstanding. So we'll, if any of you gentlemen know by chance exactly when we're supposed to be starting, it'll make it have an impact on my previous shiur. That's not the impression that I think is accurate, and it's an afkamina for me of 10 minutes of shiur. So I actually stopped in the middle of a sentence in the previous gemara. Okay. So if you're taking a look here at the third of the wide lines, you will see that line starts with the word Adifa, and we'll explain what that word Adifa is, and then we go on to Aschalta de Tumahi. Is it fair to assume that everyone has the place?
The third of the wide line?
Right. The third of the wide line, the first word in the line is Adifa, on Daf Beis Amid Beis.
Yeah.
We found it?
Yeah.
You have a different Gemara?
Yeah, it's a different one, yeah.
I see. Well, what's the nature of that Gemara? Interesting, it looks so similar to mine. Wow. Interesting.
He got a cheaper version.
Very strange.
I like to scribble a little.
I don't understand why your Gemara should be different than mine. So it is on the same line, but the line doesn't start with the word Adifa. It's strange. I wonder why that is. This baffles me. And I don't understand why that is. Okay then?
It's like to be different, don't you?
So, Abosai, are you able to concentrate? Yeah, this Gemara needs a lot of concentration.
Adifa, Echomrim.
Okay, so what's Adifa? What does the word Adifa mean? And let's review that from yesterday. Right, we're trying to understand why Rabbi Eliezer holds that in the case of Stira, like in the case of Tuma, all you require is the testimony of one witness. And the Gemara thinks that there are two candidates for an equation to Tuma. Tuma we know, and nobody questions it, the Eid Ein Ba, that all you need is one witness for Tuma. With regard to Kini and Stira, one of those two, according to Rabbi Eliezer, qualifies as being analogous to Tuma. And hence, the Torah is very machmir and says all you need is one witness. Now, which of the two, Kinui or Stira, is more analogous to Tuma? Which of the two is more profound? Yesterday we used the word primary. And the Gemara goes back and forth on this. The Gemara initially thinks on the first of the wide lines, again if you have the same Tzuras Hadaf, which you might not have, that Kinui Adif, you might find those two words on the first of the wide lines. And that's because we gave the mashal yesterday of Paraduma, that you can't bring a Karban Pesach until first you go through the ritual of Paraduma. So Paraduma makes it possible for you to bring the Karban Pesach. That gives Paraduma Adif. Adif means Adifus, means it gives it a primary significance. Here too, there's no such thing as stira. In other words, the seclusion that he has with her is only meaningful in halachic terms if it follows a kinui. Kinui has to be the opening foundation, the setting up of the framework. Without kinui, there's nothing to talk about. So that makes kinui adif. On the other hand, the Gemara thinks that stira is adif. And the reason for that is because, and that's the first of the wide lines again in my printing, stira adifa, shekena osrasa kituma. Because the very moment that she violates the kinui and she has stira and she's secluded with this man, at that moment she becomes prohibited to resume any relationship with her husband. Again, that might change if it turns out that she's guiltless. But right now, as things are, once she has stira, then she can no longer have a relationship with her husband, and that's called osrasa. Osrasa means she's prohibited. Kituma. Kituma means it's analogous to tumah. So basically at this point, the Gemara vacillates back and forth without coming to any definite conclusion as to which of the two, kinui or stira, gets the appellation adifa. Adifa is a very important victorious crowning. You know, we crown you adifa. Adifa means you are the man. You are the most primary, significant element or segment in this entire equation. Now, who is adifa? Well, on the one hand, we have an adifus here in favor of kinui, because without kinui, the whole process doesn't get off the ground, and stira would be meaningless. On the other hand, the clincher is stira, because stira generates an isur in which she's now enjoined from relations with her husband, just like tuma. So if you want to know which of the two is primary between kinui and stira, you can vacillate back and forth. And in Yiddish we say, nem de kop und schlug de wand, which means take your head and bang it against the wall. You'll never figure out the answer to this question, because there are two different perspectives and they're both correct. Kinui is adif and stira is adif. We don't know how to resolve that problem. So the Gemara now says that the final conclusion, and this is going to reflect reveal the secret that underlies Rabbi Eliezer, that stira only requires one witness, is that stira is aschalta de tumahi. Do you see those words? Aschalta de tumah. That's exactly where we left off yesterday. Now we're going to try to understand what aschalta de tumahi means, both literally and conceptually. First, let's start with the literal translation. Aschalta de tuma means the beginning of tuma. The Gemara is actually now, in a sense, integrating the last two of the three segments, the three stages, the last two of the three stages that stira and tuma belong to one unit, one entity. And that's tumah. But tumah itself has aschalta de tumah, it has the beginning of tumah, and then it has the end of tumah. So the Gemara's radical breakthrough here to establish that stira is most similar to tumah, nafgamina being that now we're going to say one witness is sufficient in stira, is because we are able to integrate stira and tumah into one whole, into one entity. And there's a beginning and there's an end. Kinui, on the other hand, belongs as an independent, separate entity. Of course, it's the precondition, it's the foundation, it sets up the framework, as we said before. It's the ikar in that sense. But as far as the process is concerned, the process doesn't begin with kinui. Now, what does that mean, the process doesn't begin with kinui? That's a ridiculous statement. You should all be throwing rotten apples, rotten tomatoes, whatever your favorite rotten fruit is, or vegetable.
It starts with kinui.
Look, or it starts with kinui. So how can I tell you that kinui is not part and parcel of a process that culminates with tumah? That's not so. Kinui is certainly stage number one. So how can you tell me that, no, stira is aschalta de tumah? In other words, the kickoff, the first stage of Tuma is Stira, but Kinui is out. You know, Kinui is outside of the pale. You know, if you had a, if you imagine a bracketed box, then you'd have Kinui outside the brackets, and you have Stira and Tuma in the brackets. Why? Because the Gemara identifies and defines Stira as Haschalta de Tuma. Haschalta means the beginning. Anything before that is not part of the beginning. Do you follow me? Like, for example, it says, Bereishis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim ves ha-aretz. So Rabbi Avo in the Medrash says that God created many worlds and He destroyed them. This was the last experiment. There were a couple of failed experiments that took place before. But what's the Tchilas Bereishis? What's the beginning of the process of creation that's an entity called Bereishis bara Elokim? That's going to be the first day of the 7 days of creation. Anything that God created before that is outside the pale of that entity of creation that has 7 days to it. So too, we have an entity that's called Tuma. And what is the kickoff? What is the beginning of Tuma? Everybody, what's the beginning of Tuma? Aschalta de Tuma? Stira. And where is Kinui? Kinui is the introduction, and it's absolutely necessary, but it's not part of Tuma.
Nor is it an action.
Oh. So good. So you're already answering my question. I didn't even get a chance to answer the question. My question was, why is it that Stira is upgraded here in this Gemara by Rabbi Eliezer to the status of Aschalta de Tuma? Why do you choose to upgrade Stira to the level of Aschalta de Tuma? The Gemara until now was saying that Adarabba Kinui Adiv Shekein Ikar Garamla. That there's no such thing as Stira without Kinui, and therefore Kinui is Adiv. Adiv means superior. It is fundamental and primary. Now all of a sudden we leave Kinui outside. You know, let's say it rains outside, so Kinui is now going to be in the rain, and we're going to allow Stira to enter into the house, you know, with the protective roof. So you're not out in the exposed to the natural elements. Why? Because Stira is Aschalta de Tuma. Why is Stira Aschalta de Tuma? The Gemara just finished telling me that Adarabba Kinui is Aduf. Because the entire process is set into motion by what? By Kinui. Without Kinui, there's nothing to talk about. Stira here is Ahin, Stira Her. She could have Stira from now till doomsday. It's totally meaningless. She's not a Sota. In order for her to be a Sota through the Stira, you have to have Kinui. So Kinui is what sets the whole process into motion, and He gives it the framework, and therefore the Gemara says, Kinui Adif. Now if you think Berzon created those words, Kinui Adif, take a look at the Gemara. The Gemara says, on the first of the wide lines in my printed Gemara, I don't know where it is in your printed Gemara, Kinui Adif. So why is Kinui Adif, and yet at the same time, the Gemara says, Aschalta de Tuma is what? Stira is Aschalta de Tuma, and Kinui is outside the pale. So that's where we get confused. So what I want to present to you is the commentary of what's called the Tiferes Tzion. He lived about 150 years ago. I forget his name right now. The reason why I forget his name is because I live in two places. I live in Har Nof, and I live on Rehov Rabbi Meir in Katamon. And I never remember where I put which sefer. So the sefer that would tell me who the Tiferes Tzion is, which is called Beis Akeid Sfarim by a fellow named Friedberg, that sefer I have here in Rabbi Meir. And I thought I had it in Har Nof on Rehov Sholzen. Anyway, so the Tiferes Tzion says the following. There are two perspectives on Sota. One perspective is what we call the legal perspective. The other perspective is the religious perspective. I'll try to explain what that means. All of halacha could be broken down. Almost every action in halacha can be broken down into two different categories or two different perspectives. One perspective is purely legal. And what that means is that halacha is a legal system, like any other legal system. And if you don't believe me, then you have to come to my Thursday class at 9:30. Okay, fine. So this halacha is a legal system. Now, you and I know that every legal system is built on procedure. And when you build a legal system on procedure, then what it means is that the law is contingent on procedure. Let's say, for example, if I want to purchase your real estate. So there are certain procedures. The law says I can't just say, well, I hereby declare myself the owner of your flat, of your apartment, right? Even if you would agree and you would say, yeah, Berzon, you could have my flat. That would not be enough to effectuate a transaction. Transactions and changes in legal status require procedural requirements. Anybody here in this room a lawyer? No? We don't have any lawyers here. But anyway, that's what law is all about. It's all about procedure. So to document something, you need a certain documentation. It might have to be registered with a notary public. It might have to be registered with the municipality, with the federal government. I mean, there are a million different requirements and in procedural law. Then, halacha has a different perspective, a different variable. And that is what I call the religious variable. And what that means is that the halacha doesn't just depend upon procedure, but it also is a function of mitzvos and averos. That sometimes the guilt for violating a criminal law is more important and takes precedence over procedure. And we could give many, many examples of the differences. Let me try to give our example because I think it's one of the best of them all. From a procedural perspective, kinui is adif. Why? Because the entire process, the legal process of sota, is engendered by, or shall we say, generated by the procedure called kinui. Without kinui, there's no such thing as sota. So if you want to set up a legal entity called sota, you have to begin with what? What's going to be the background? What's going to be the ritual or procedural necessary condition? It's going to be what? Kinui. Stira plays a different role. The role of stira is in religious law, which means that sota is not just a legal status that requires procedure. Sota is also a result of criminal violation. From the perspective of criminal violation, which is adif, which is superior? Kinui. Now again, the kinui might be a result of the fact that, you know, circumstances were such that the husband began to suspect his wife. You know, she was flirting with other men, with another man, and so forth and so on. But that's not really criminal violation. At what moment of time did she violate the law? Is she guilty of an avera?
Stira.
So the Gemara now vacillates back and forth. The Gemara thinks that there are two perspectives. From the perspective of procedural law, meaning generating a legal change, kinui is adif. And that was the hava mina, that the Gemara thinks that in that sense, kinui, like tumah itself, should be elevated to the status of one witness, meaning the Torah should be machmir in kinui, because from a procedural perspective, kinui is adif in that it sets up the entire process, the legal process of what? Of sota. The Gemara now rejects that in order to defend Rabbi Eliezer, because Rabbi Eliezer accepts the analogy between what and tumah? Stira and tumah. Everybody have that? And he rejects the analogy between kinui and tumah. Why? Because the Gemara now is on a different track, a different way of thinking, a different set of rules or different perspective. Now the Gemara takes up the perspective that let's look at sota, analyze sota, not from a legal perspective in terms of the procedural law, because then for sure, which is adif, keener yizadu, but rather from the perspective of avera. That's what I think you meant by maisa.
Yes.
That the maisa avera of stira, once there was a kinui, that begins the process of tumah. And I'll prove it to you. Because if she doesn't drink from the name Merorim after stira, for whatever reason, like for example in contemporary life, then she is asura al baila. She can no longer resume the relationship. Why? Because the stira itself is an avera. She had no right to go into this room in a secluded place with this man. Again, not because of the laws of Yichud. It's very likely that her husband is somewhere within the city limits, as we discussed yesterday. So there's no Avera in the Yichud per se, but there's an Avera called Stira, which follows Kinui. And the husband is given the rights by the Torah to warn her and enjoin her from having a secluded relationship with so-and-so. But when she violates that law, that's what generates tumah. And tumah doesn't depend upon whether she actually had that illicit relationship. Even in the absence of that illicit relationship, tumah has already begun. And how do I know that the tumah has already begun? Because after stira, she's not allowed to go back to her husband until we can prove her innocent and exonerate her through a process called shtias mei merorim. But without the shtias mei merorim, she's asur al baila, and that means that tumah has already set in. What is the tumah? We think that the contamination of tumah that prohibits on the baal is the actual maisa bia. Nein, that's not so. The stira itself is the maisa bia. This is the Teferes Tzion. If you like it, applaud. If you don't like it, then reject it. That's up to you. But, you know, he was one of the Gedolei Yisrael.
Could you maybe say, Rabbi, that because you're saying that what stira starts, that's the beginning of the process, that's what you're saying, the guilty in terms of religious...
On a religious level, that's the critical element in the process, meaning religious violation, which is called an avera, that avera is completely inherent in stira as opposed to kinui. But kinui has a superior status in terms of what?
The legal.
Procedural, excellent, legal.
So what I was going to say, well, surely because that's where the process begins, not the legal process, but in terms of the breaking the religious law, you said, but she's...
What are we talking about now? Kinui or stira?
Stira,
excellent.
So what I was going to say is, maybe there is an argument then that you need two witnesses for stira.
No.
Not one.
No, I'll tell you why. Because what does the Torah say about tumah? And what I'm about to tell you is universally accepted. Nobody questions this. We finally got to one point where there's no machlokas. That's very rare in Shas. And that is tumah. In the case of tumah, everybody agrees. And how many witnesses do we require? Only one. So now if we're going to inject stira into the process of what? Of tumah, that's called aschalto de tumah, then one aid, one witness is enough. Hence I have the sheet to Rabbi Eliezer. And for stira, all I need is one witness. So the Gemara says, masnisin de lo ki haitana. This is Rabosai, such a classic Talmudic phrase. Masnisin de lo ki haitana. You know that most of Shas is about Mishnayos and Brisos. Right? So the Brisos were written by the Tanoim, and they record the opinions of the Tanoim, but they were omitted from the Mishnah. Again, we have to know why. And who made that decision, by the way, whether a particular Tanakh statement would be included in the Mishnah or omitted from the Mishnah, left into a Brisa. The prince. What was his first name? We know him on a first basis. He's a good buddy of ours. His name was Judah, right? Rabbi Yehuda Nasi Yisrael. He was the chief of Israel. So he was Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, otherwise known shortly as Rebbe, and he made that decision. Again, it's not for us today. We would really have to have a couple hours of discussion here about why. What were the guidelines that Rebbe made his decision this way or that way? But he was like the attorney general, if you know what I mean. All the power was in his hands. The whole future of Israel is in the hands of Rebbe Yehuda Nasi. One man. And he's going to decide what's in the Mishnah and what's left out of the Mishnah. So the Gemara says, Masnisen, our Mishnah, Delo is against Ki Hai Tana, like this following Tana, who is not recorded in the Mishnah. So it's really interesting. Rebbe decided that the correct transmission of Rabbi Eliezer is the one that Rebbe included in the Mishnah. And Rebbe omitted a different transmission of Rabbi Eliezer's view, which was recorded in a Braisa, Desanya. Now, whenever you see the word Desanya, you take it apart. You have the Dalid, and then the word Tanya. And that's an absolute rule, all over Shas. De, Tanya. The De, the Dalid at the beginning, is part of the conjugation. The actual noun is Tanya. Tanya means a Braisa. De Tanya means it was taught in a Braisa. Now this Braisa is going to quote Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda. And if you ever get a chance, you might want to read about Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda. He was a very powerful Tana. He appears in some of the most profound sugyos in Shas. And he was a Talmud of Rabbi Eliezer. And he very often has a different version of what Rabbi Eliezer actually said. And in this particular case, it's Pumfakert. Pumfakert means the exact opposite. He's going to turn the entire globe of Rabbi Eliezer and Sota upside down and inside out. Whatever we thought until now about Rabbi Eliezer, forget it. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda wants to set the record straight, and we made a bunch of errors in the way we understood and formulated the sheet of Rabbi Eliezer. What was Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda's transmission of Rabbi Eliezer? Hamakane li ishto. Now we said until now that even Rabbi Eliezer agrees to Rabbi Yoshua that in the case of Kinui, how many witnesses do we need?
Two
witnesses. Take a look at Rabbi Yossi's formulation. He says, Hamakane li ishto, Mekane alpi eid echad o alpi atzmo. The exact opposite of what we said until now. That according to this version of Rabbi Eliezer, one witness suffices, and for that matter, even the husband's own claim, his own testimony, as far as Kina is concerned. Umashkela, but she will only drink from the Mayim Hamararim after the second stage. What's the second stage?
Stira.
Al Pishnayim. The Stira has to have two witnesses. So it's unbelievable that this Braisa records Rabbi Eliezer's view just the opposite of the way we have it. We have it in our Mishnah that Kinui requires two witnesses and Stira requires only one witness. And we worked very hard to explain the underlying logic. Now Rabbi Yossi has a different view, a different transmission of Rabbi Eliezer, and it's Pumfaker. Because in the case of Kinui, Rabbi Eliezer says, all you need is one aid. In the case of Stira, you need two witnesses. The exact opposite. So therefore, Masnisin Delo Ki Hai Tana. Our Mishnah is against the Tana of our Mishnah.
Is that a problem?
I'm sorry. Our Mishnah is against the Tana, the Braisa.
Isn't it problematic that a Braisa is trying to contradict a Mishnah?
No, I'll tell you why. Because, I'll give you an example. You know, my Rebbe was Rabbi Soloveitchik. If you would ask me what Rabbi Soloveitchik said, I'll tell you what he said. If you ask, and I'll give you a list of about 50 people, what Rabbi Soloveitchik said, many of them will say that he said the exact opposite.
Why?
Now, how did that happen? Two possibilities. The most logical possibility is that Rabbi Soloveitchik himself changed his mind. So I was there in his youth, and you were there, sitting at his feet, in his older years. And in the middle, he changed his mind. For example, the Rambam wrote the Pirush HaMishnayos when he was 30 years old. He wrote his magnum opus, the Mishnah Torah, when he was 60 years old. 30 years later, he changed his mind constantly. So people look at the Rambam and they say, well, wait a minute, there's a stira here. The Rambam contradicts himself. The answer is, the Rambam had two different opinions. And they were mutually exclusive because he changed his mind. Others say that the reason why we have other versions of the Tanna is because of the Golos, the long, bitter exile, you know, the Babylonian exile, and things got lost in transmission. And there really is only one correct transmission of what Rabbi Eliezer said. So it's up to you to choose which of those approaches you like.
The Mishnah is a higher authority. You're talking about like students changing their minds about what your Rav said, but if there was a
you see,
a tape
David,
recording,
the word authority is a very, very loaded word. You mean by authority, halachic authority, what we call in fancy English normative halacha, you're 100% right. I cannot disagree with you by one iota. The Mishnah has a lot more of authority than the Braisa. But if you're talking about what is true and what is not true, then a Braisa has no less authority than a Mishnah. Because although the Mishnah reflects the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and that's how he understood the transmission of Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda in the Braisa had a different transmission. And they're both emes. Now, how can two things that are mutually exclusive be emes? That has to do with the principle which you want to write down. If you like to write notes, that's called Elu V'Elu Divrei Elokim Chayim. Are you familiar with that? Elu V'Elu Divrei Elokim Chayim. Beis Hillel could say one thing. Beis Shammai will say the exact opposite. And Elu V'Elu, they're both giving us Divrei Elokim Chayim. How could that be? Obviously, the Torah's perspective on truth and falsehood is totally different than the human intuitive understanding of what truth and falsehood is, so that two people could say the opposite, they're both right. How could that be? The Torah has many different perspectives. But in any event, getting back to our Gemara, what we have is that according to this Braisa of Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Eliezer said just the exact opposite of what he's quoted as saying in the Mishnah, namely that Kinui does not require two witnesses. And stira requires two witnesses. Heshivu chachamim, and the chachamim were upset with Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda. Now, I'm looking at my clock. How much time do we have? About 25 minutes?
No, I don't think that.
20 minutes, whatever we have. Okay, whatever the amount of time is, you'll leave when you have to go. I can go on for hours, but what we're going to do is we're going to try to figure out why the Chachamim rejected Rabbi Eliezer. Now watch this. Ve'ishivu Chachamim, the Chachamim rejected this Rabbi Eliezer, could be understood in two ways. And you'll tell me which one is correct and which one is not correct. A, it could be understood as a rejection of Rabbi Eliezer, period. Or B, it could be understood as a rejection of Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda's transmission of Rabbi Eliezer. Which of those is probably the right way of going?
The second one.
But now we get into real dangerous, treacherous territory, because what we're going to see is that the objection of the Chachamim to Rabbi Eliezer would equally apply in our Mishnah as well. That's what this whole sugya that we're about to embark upon is all about. And again, it's a very profound sugya with back and forth and nuances and understandings. And hopefully, you know, by the time Rabbi Myers gets back, I think he'll be back for Sunday, he won't have to deal with any of these issues because he'll be in the next Gemara. So he owes us a debt of gratitude, because the sugya that we're about to learn is quite choppy. You know, it's quite profound. So let's see if we can appreciate the objection of the Chachamim. Heshivu Chachamim, the Chachamim responded in the following way. L'divrei Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, which means we're about to object to that particular transmission, meaning Rabbi Yossi's transmission, Ein l'davar sof. Now, I'm going to translate Ein l'davar sof literally.
No way.
And then I'm going to translate it more figuratively, which is exactly what you have to do when you learn Shas. You have to first translate the words, and then you have to see what they mean. And very often the meaning goes way beyond the literal translation of their words. Ein l'davar sof means there's no end. It's endless. Now, the original phrase, Ein l'davar sof, appears in the first Mishnah in Masechet Yoma. The Mishnah establishes that you have to set up an alternative replacement wife for the Kohen Gadol before he goes in on Yom Kippur to do the Avodah. Why? Because the Torah says that a Kohen Gadol can only serve on Yom Kippur if he has a wife. Now we're afraid that he might lose his wife, so we actually have to appoint, designate a second wife. So the Mishnah says, "Ein l'davar so." What do you think the Mishnah means?
The second wife could also die.
Exactly, the second wife might die. So you're going to appoint the third wife. Well, she might die. Till you get to the point where all the women in the world die. That's not very good. We need the women folk, right? I mean, you know, just like we need Kinu to get to Stira, we need women to get to Kinu and Stira. No, that was just a bad joke. Anyway, so that's called Ein L'davar Sof. Ein L'davar Sof means that you're in a domino kind of reaction where you'll never get out of it. You know, you caught up in what we call a vicious cycle, and the Israelis call it Magal Ksamim. It just goes around and around and around, and you'll never break through. You know, I had a discussion, and maybe you were with me when we discussed the international dateline. The international dateline is also based on Ein L'davar Sof. Because if you don't, because since the globe is round, if you keep going around the globe and around the globe, you'll never get to the point where you change the date. So you have to change the date at some point when you go around the globe. So that's called Ein L'davar Sof. However, my friends, Ein L'davar Sof has another meaning as well. And this is atypical. This is not your typical understanding of Ein L'davar Sof. Ein L'davar Sof means that sociologically, in terms of the way the society functions, you have opened yourself up to an impossible situation and you'll never be able to get out of it. Let's understand. According to Rabbi Yossi, how many witnesses does Rabbi Eliezer require for Stira?
Two.
Two witnesses, okay? Now, watch what happens. A man, again, I hate to say this because, you know, we think all men are good people, right? So I don't like to accuse a man of being not such a good person. But let's say a man wants to mess up his wife. He's angry at her tremendously. He blames her for God knows what. The man lost his job, he lost his money, and he thinks his wife was the cause of it all. She messed up. Now, hopefully no one here ever experienced that. But if you experience that, you have two options. One option is to give your wife a divorce, correct? And that could be one way out of this. The other way out of it is to make her into a sota. And that could be advantageous because if she becomes a sota, she might actually die. So if he's very angry at his wife, again, we don't commit murder, right? You know, somebody once asked my father, may he rest in peace, if he ever considered divorcing my mother. He said, divorce never, but murder many times. So that was my father's sense of humor. But the truth is that if a man wants to mess up his wife, unless the halacha protects her interest, this is very, very dangerous that you can give him almost carte blanche to make his wife into a sota. So how does that happen?
You can't make your wife into a sota.
I'll tell you how you can make your wife into a sota. Watch this. According to this transmission of Rabbi Eliezer. Now, as I told you before, a married woman is allowed to be alone with another man. In most cases, unless the husband is out of the city limits. Okay? So let's say, I'll just try to, just arbitrarily a number, in 99 out of 100 cases, a woman who's married is allowed to be alone with another man. You know, if he's a traveler, then obviously the statistics change. Today we live in a world of travel. But back in the day, people didn't travel. My father's actually named after his uncle, who traveled from a city called Plisa to Lubavitch. Lubavitch was a city, and he went because they were Lubavitch and Hasidim. They found him 6 months later frozen to a tree. Because when he left Plisa, the weather was glorious. But very quickly, the weather changed on his way, and he froze to death. There's a whole question whether you name someone after someone who died tragically. I don't want to get into that whole thing. But anyway, my father was named after his uncle. His uncle's name was Dov Aryeh. So why do I mention this to you? Because back in the day, travel was very dangerous. So in most cases, I would submit to you that a husband is local. at least back in the day. Again, culture and contemporary society has changed. But today, many men, just they're always traveling. Women are travelers too. But so in those days, you know, you very much stayed close to home. So imagine the following scenario. Two men are walking down the street, and they notice that the mailman goes into the house, and the door closes behind. And she, the wife, is alone in the house with the mailman. No prohibition was violated, because the husband is somewhere in the city. But two witnesses saw that. And there's no reason why witnesses wouldn't see that. Now the husband could make her into a sota. How? He comes into Beis Din and he says, which is a total bluff, a total fabrication, that I gave this woman, my wife, kinui. I had warned her not to be alone with the mailman, whatever man he is, doesn't matter. She becomes a sota. And a sota is not something you want to be. It could be very dangerous. Do you follow what happens? Give me just one more minute. What does Ein L'Davar Sof mean? Ein L'Davar Sof means that you've structured the law in such a way that a man has it within him, given society, to make a woman into a sota. Now you'll say, wait a minute. Kini requires one witness. That's not what it says. There are two possibilities for kinui, according to Rabbi Yossi in his transmission. Either one witness or...
two.
Or, look inside, just to refresh your memory. Al Piatzmo. He himself could claim, I gave her a kinui. So imagine if a man wants to make his wife into a sota, he doesn't have to work very hard to do so. Because there'll always be two edim on stira. Because stira itself is part of the natural course of events. So all he has to do is fabricate a story about kinui. And he's believed without any testimony whatsoever that he gave a kinui. So on Tuesday, the mailman went into the house and a bunch of men saw it, or two men saw it. And the husband comes running into Beis Din and he says to Beis Din, on Monday, the day before the milkman came in, I told her don't be alone with the milkman. And we have no way of contradicting him. Because he's neman al piatzmo. That's what the Gemara calls ein l'davar sof. Ein l'davar sof means that the law has to protect the rights of a woman. It cannot leave a woman vulnerable to the possibility that the husband, just because he gets angry at his wife, he can set up a scenario where she will become a sota. And the Gemara assumes that there's no issue. He's going to have no sweat, no problem getting two witnesses on stira, because that's built into the nature of society.
But it's only an accusation. It is not the absolute condition of the woman.
She may survive the Mei Maroran, right? But she may not survive the Mei Maroran.
Okay, but that is the essence of the determination of whether she indeed truly is a sota.
So
she
correct. Maybe he won't succeed in murdering his wife. You know, at the end of the day, maybe she'll survive. But what he will succeed is in busting up the marriage.
Yes. Presumably, also her reputation will be ruined now that she's a sota woman, even if she comes up.
That's right.
Still, the accusation was made.
Yeah, that's true too. Okay. Again, we're going to see as we go along through Masech the Sota, we're only on that phase, what are all the implications of her being a Sota? It's not just all about whether she'll survive the Mei Merari. Yeah. David.
So, surely, we're putting a very passive predicament on this woman. She must know, she's not stupid. She must also be aware of the Sota process, and therefore one has to question why she's even allowing somebody into her house to generate this.
Because every single woman in town allows the milkman to schlep the milk into the house. Milk is very heavy.
But you don't close the door.
You see, the trouble with you gentlemen is that you get so stuck in reality that... it makes it so difficult to learn Gemara. Gemara is not about reality. Gemara is about concepts. And I, again, you know, I can only tell you that after trying to learn Gemara for 6 decades and more. I don't want to tell you how old I am. I started learning Gemara when I was very young. Gemara is about concepts. Now, you fill in the details. That's your responsibility. That's not the Gemara's responsibility. The Gemara is assuming that yichud, which means a woman, a married woman, being alone with a man, was maisim b'chol yom. It was something that took place on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I call it the milkman. You want to call it the mailman. You call it whoever you want. That's your headache. You don't come into my class and ask me, well, was it the milkman or was it the... I'm not interested in that.
The plumber.
You know what I'm saying?
The plumber.
The plumber, right? The plumber comes in, he's fixing the tub. Yeah. So what? You can't get two witnesses to testify that the plumber went into the house? And by the way, we're going to see later on, how long do they have to be alone? Very short period of time. That's a suya nafdal. That I'm going to leave for my mind.
That's a sneeze. Yeah.
But the Gemara says it's as long as it takes to crack an egg and fry it. You know, it's I don't know how many seconds they have to be alone. So to find two witnesses to testify in that sociology that a woman was alone, secluded for 5 seconds was not a big deal. But now you've given the husband an unbelievable joker card in his pocket. You've equipped him with an absolute ability to make her into a sota. Because all he has to do is saying that I gave a kino yesterday, and now she's alone with the milkman. So that's called Ein L'Dover Sof. Let's go into the Gemara now, because we don't have too much time, but at least I want to read the Gemara. My time under Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda. What led Rav Yossi Rav Yehuda to this opinion, this conclusion, that Rabbi Eliezer's logic is binding, not binding, what word is convincing, that there's a convincing logic here that stira should require two witnesses? And the answer is, Amar Krabba. We're going back now to the whole drasha business. You remember that the Torah says, the aid ain't ba, and we said yesterday that the word ba is a superfluous word that comes from a mute as an exclusion. Velo bistira, that meaning if you're talking about tumah, the Torah says that all you need is one witness. Aid ain, and then the Torah adds ba to the exclusion of stira. So the Gemara says v'ema, why not say ba velo bikinui? Maybe ba is telling you that in the case of kinui, you do not need two witnesses and all you need is one witness. So the Gemara answers, no, kinui is kashlutuma, because we have an equation between kinui and tuma, and in the process of that equation, Rabbi Yossi is going to conclude in the framework of Rabbi Eliezer that all you need is one aid for kinui, just like all you need is one aid for tuma. So you follow what's going on over here. Now we're using ba to exclude kinui, and we're jacking up the requirement in kinui just 1 second. Where am I?
Jack it down.
Jack it down and jack it up, depending upon which way you want to see. But basically, what we're saying is that stira requires two witnesses. And why does stira require two witnesses? Because ba velo bistira. And now we're saying that we're not going to dash in bavelo bikinui, but rather, as far as kinui is concerned, all we need is one aid, because we're going to accept an equation between kinui and tumah. Where's the equation between kinui and tumah? Dichsiv, because the pasuk says v'kinas ishto v'hi nitma. So in the same breath, the Torah talks about kinui and tumah. So the Gemara right away objects, stira nami is kishlu tumah. This sounds familiar to you. We already have an equation between stira and tumah. The Chassivit says v'nistra v'nitma. So the Gemara says, hahu, that equation between stira and tumah is lakama to answer the question how much shear is the duration of stira. What's the shear of stira? How long does she have to be alone in order for these witnesses to establish that she was alone, which is called stira? The answer is kidei tuma hu diasa. Kidei tuma means as long as it takes for she and him to have this illicit relationship, which again, that's a sugya daf dalet. It's a very short period of time. And who the osa, that's what this pasuk of this equation of the nistor of Nitmo is coming to teach us. So the Gemara says, Yeshivu chachamim l'divrei Rav Yossi b'Rav Yehuda ein l'dover sof. My ninu, what does this mean? My ninu, what ninu does this mean? And the answer is, the zimnin delo kati, in certain cases, he, the husband, never actually, in reality, gave her kinui, the Omar Kanoi, but he's going to claim that I have warned her, that I actually gave her a warning. So he's angry at his wife. There are two witnesses that saw her go alone with another man, and as I said before, that's not forbidden because her husband is somewhere in the city limits. And now he just fabricates the whole story of kinui. And as a result, he makes his wife into a sota. So the Gemara says, wait a minute, this objection of Heshivu Chachamim is only relevant to Rabbi Eliezer as recorded and transmitted by Rabbi Yossi. Halu Mishnah Seinu, Yesh L'Dover Sof. Are you implying that in the case of our Mishnah, Yesh L'Dover Sof, in other words, he should be believed and there's no problem? Well, I'm going to demonstrate to you that the objection of the Chachom applies even in Rabbi Eliezer in our Mishnah. Why? Zimnin Delois Tater. There are situations in which he did not violate the Kinui. So again, we're going to Rabbi Eliezer in the Mishnah. Rabbi Eliezer in the Mishnah requires how many Eidim for Kinui? Everybody. Two witnesses. So he gives her the Kinui in front of two witnesses. And then, in order to make her into a sota, all he has to do is, V'amar, he has to declare, istater, that she secluded herself with this man. Why? Because according to Rabbi Eliezer in our Mishnah, one witness is believed in stira, right? That was the whole point, that stira is aschalta de tumah, and therefore we equate stira with tumah. Just like tumah requires only one witness, stira likewise only requires one witness. And not only one witness, but he himself is believed on the stira. So if a man wants to get his wife into trouble and make her into a sota, then he can easily do so simply by giving her kinui in front of two witnesses. All he needs is kinui in front of two witnesses, and the rest is history. Where is the security here? Where is the breaks or the protection of the woman's rights over here? No matter which way you take Rabbi Eliezer, you know, Bishlam, if you go like Rabbi Yeshua requires two witnesses on both what? Kinui and stira. So there's no way that he can bluff it and fabricate a kinui or a stira. But according to Rabbi Eliezer, who disagrees with Rabbi Yoshua, he's believed, and if he could fabricate, what's he going to fabricate? Well, according to Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, he's going to fabricate a kinui, and he's lying about kinui, it never took place. According to the Mishnah and its transmission, Rabbi Eliezer, he's going to fabricate stira. So he'll give a kinui in front of two witnesses, and then he'll tell us a whole bluff about stira. So therefore, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Yosef, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, af even l'divrei Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, ein l'dover sof. In other words, if you add the word af to the text of the Braisa, it means that even according to Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda's transmission of the Shita of Rabbi Eliezer, there is a problem of Ein L'Dover Sof, and that's why the Chachamim will object. And we're adding one piece of the puzzle. According to our Mishnah, for sure, there is Ein L'Dover Sof, because all he has to do, according to our Mishnah, is to fabricate the stira. The whole story of stira is just his own fabrication. And as we said before, he'll give a kinui in front of two witnesses, and then he'll fabricate the story about stira. But even according to Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, we still have an Ein L'Dover Sof situation, because according to Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, he, the husband, if he's angry at his wife, he could fabricate the story of kinui. She went in to seclude it with the milkman. There were two witnesses who saw that, and now he's going to make a whole story here about kinui. Okay, Rabbi Yossi, we'll pick up Rabbi Yossi tomorrow, And let's make a note of where we got up to so that tomorrow we'll be able to fit this in. And we're up to Af L'Divrei Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda. Do you have that?
What is the punishment of the man who makes the fabrication? There has to be a consequence for what he's doing.
That's going to be the Chachomim's objection to Rabbi Eliezer. We don't understand Rabbi Eliezer at this point. You know, I wish I had a solution for you, but right now the Gemara says there's no solution. Right. There's no way we can disprove him because, according to Rabbi Eliezer, the Torah relies on his testimony. So where's the system of what we call in America justice. Checks and balances? There's justice. No checks and balances
no
over
justice.
Here. There's no breaks over here because once you give him the belief, you give him what's called nemanus, the credibility, either for kinui or for stira, whichever way you go, then it's a cinch for him to make his wife into a sota with all the terrible repercussions down the line. And that's why the Chachamim object to Rabbi Elias. Okay then, gentlemen? So I'm keeping you to suspense.
You know, with your wife's election, as he got older, he changed his opinion. Does that mean if he goes back to his old notes?
If he goes back to?
His old notes or his own quotation, does he say those are no longer acceptable?
I don't know if you ever heard of Dr. Lamb. He was the president of Yeshiva University. Yeah. He's retired now.
Yeah.
And Dr. Lamb said that one day in Shia, the Rav was reading his notes and